discussed CMB a little bit more. And so we discussed that it encodes actually information not only about the temperature, which can be expanded in the spherical harmonics. The fluctuations of the temperature can be expanded in the spherical harmonics, but it also contains information about the polarization. And the simple reason is that when the CMB was produced, actually it was, you know, polarized. And so you can describe the polarization tensor. You can expand it in the corresponding basis. And so these things here, Y, I, J, L, M, E, and B, they are tensorial harmonics. So you basically act as some operator on your spherical harmonics. But wonderful thing about these beasts is that they, again, form a complete basis. And they are orthogonal in right sense and so on. So really, this, you know, this expansion, you know, it's a complete basis. So you can expand in these things. So, and that defines these ALMs for the electric polarization and for the magnetic polarization. So now, having defined all these quantities, you can now consider, you know, not only the power spectrum for the temperature, but you can also consider all possible, you know, combinations of the correlations, two-point correlation functions of, you know, A, L, M, E, T, and B. And so, for example, this is an example, so there's probably missing star. You can consider ALM of T and AL prime M prime of B, and that defines your CLTB. So now, lots of these things actually do vanish. And so, for example, this CLTB does vanish because of the parity argument. And similarly, if you put E and B, that would again vanish because of the parity argument. But you can have things like CL, EE, CLTT, we know already. But also, most importantly, to have fun, you can also have CLBB. So this is the only non-trivial power spectrum for the B modes, or for this guy. And so why this power spectrum is interesting is that there's only three sources which can actually produce, which have contributions to this CLBB. So first is the gravity waves, basically produced by inflation. Second is the gravitational lensing as the light travels through there. And then you can also have a polarized dust in the universe, which actually, you know, produces this P polarization. So now if you look at and plot this picture of CLBB, then this thing here, it looks quite boring. Well, I'll upgrade it a little bit. So this thing is due to lensing, the gravitational lensing, and it's just, you know, flat and but if you did produce lots of gravitational waves during inflation, you might see a bump like this here. So this will be the gravity wave bump. Okay. And so people thought maybe actually the third source is not that important. And if the third thought was not important, but the gravity waves actually did exist, you would see a picture like this. And so that was the prediction. And so now came this amazing measurement in 2014 by SEP2, you probably heard of. And so they actually, so BICEP stands for this imaging of this B mode. And it's precisely this device here. It's a cold place, but so it's like Sheldon going to measure magnetic monopoles and whatever. So anyway, so BICEP2, and so what they measured is precisely this. Okay, so then, of course, this was a big discovery, and they claimed, yeah, we discovered the gravitational waves. It was actually before LIGO, right? So discovery of gravitational waves, of gravity waves, and which caused, you know, huge excitement. Of course, these waves are different than you know, the other detectors measure. So what gravity waves now measure are the gravity waves produced you know, binary star collisions and stuff like that. So here you would really be observing gravity waves produced by inflation in the early universe. Okay, so anyway, so there was this huge announcement, but some people actually did not believe it. And interestingly, Neil Turok was the first person who did not believe this. And so they wrote a paper, this something fishy there. And so what actually turned out is that they used some data from the early experiments, and they basically underestimated this polarized dust effect, because, you know, they thought this it wasn't properly measured then. But actually now it turns out that this bump is precisely can be produced by this polarized dust, and all the measurements sort of fit. And moreover, to have this thing produced by gravitational waves, this is now basically excluded by the Planck data. So actually, so this was contradiction with Planck and also with Neil. And that's why it cannot be true. And so indeed, actually, this effect, probably now people believe it's entirely caused by this polarized dust. And then, you know, we haven't seen these gravitational waves produced in the early inflation. So by the way, there's this number, this amazing prediction out of this 2014 thing. So there's a number R, which is basically the amplitude of gravity waves versus the amplitude of scale waves. And so the prediction of almost every theory is that this number should be equal to zero. But what they actually, if this were really gravity waves, what they claimed that this is 0.2 plus minus something. And if this were true, if the amplitude of the gravitational waves was that strong, it would basically rule out any theory of early universe we would have. Okay, so this was another reason why people didn't believe. In particular, Neil's favorite theory of early universe, of course, predicts this ratio to be equal to zero. And so that's why he had a motivation not to believe this result. So anyway, so this is the device. So the left one is the Bicep 2. And so what they really do is they measure these B modes, and they produce this CLBB graph, if you want. And so this is the new device, Keck, which basically is doing the same thing. And now it's already Bicep 3 operational. And so there is, so this is a different view. So again, this is the first one is Keck. So now this is the picture I showed you. So you see the data from Bicep 2 and from Keck array. And so you precisely see this excess, the bump, which, you know, they interpreted as gravitational waves, but actually it's not gravitational waves at all. So anyway, so I would just, you know, like to conclude here about CMB. So it's not only the temperature data, which you already know, this is the temperature graph, CLTT, but you can have many other power spectra, and in particular CLBB is quite an interesting spectrum. And it's been measured now, and it tells you something about the universe. Yes?
The x-axis is the same in this graph and in the previous one?
The x-axis.
Yeah.
So this thing is L.
Yeah. But why here the bar are very big on big L and on the temperature?
Oh, so this is the actual experimental.
Oh, it's not theoretical.
So. No, this is not theoretical. It's the actual experimental thing. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so can I have the screen up, please? Very good. So we discussed this CMB. So let me now start part B. And that will be inflation. And so we already discussed that inflation is good because it explains three puzzles. But the reason why most people believe now in inflation is that actually it provides the right fluctuations, if you want, which actually are seeds of our inhomogeneities in the universe, like galaxies and stuff like that. It's a generator of perturbations. So first, I will try to outline the fairy tale which we are trying to achieve. So to understand what's going on, we first consider a very, you know, toy model you consider a free scalar field in the FRW spacetime. And so what it is doing, if we now allow for some small spatial fluctuations. Okay, so the toy model is just consider a fast, massless scalar field, which will be our inflaton or whatever, so scalar. And so whenever people do these calculations, they take that we have flat universe, really k plus 1 or plus 1 or minus 1 is important later. But so in FRW with k equals to 0 spatial geometry. So we have flat universe. So our metric is the simplest one you can imagine. So it's just d squared is minus dt squared. And now I'll be using the coordinates xi, which are the original coordinates. The first coordinates I wrote down. So it's plus a squared dx squared. So dx1, dx2, dx3 squared. So this is the simplest metric, almost flat apart from the scale factor here. So that's our FRW for k equals 0. And now we consider the massless scalar field in this fixed background, which we now allow for fluctuations. So S is just d4x square root of g, and then minus 1 half d phi square. Okay. So now, if you use this metric, of course, what this thing is g mu nu with the indices upstairs, d mu d nu is the indices downstairs. And then we also need the determinant of the metric. If you look at this metric, determinant is a to the 6, square root of that is a cube. Okay, so now if you write it in terms of this metric, you get an integral over dt d3x. And then 1 half is there. And then the determinant is a cube. And then the time part is just phi dot square. But then the inverse metric is 1 over a square. So it's phi dot square. Phi dot square minus 1 over a square nabla phi square. Well, this is the spatial thing as you know it in flat space. Okay, so this is what we have. So now you vary this equation with respect to phi to get the equations of motion for phi. So variation delta phi. And it's so we have already done that if we didn't have the spatial fluctuations. So this is the extra piece, which we didn't consider before. But we had a potential. So if you replace the potential in your equations, you know, with the spatial fluctuations, then you are right. So anyway, so this is the equation, phi double dot plus 3h phi dot. And then this would be the potential part. But instead, you have this spatial fluctuation part. Okay, so that's our equation of motion for the field in a fixed FRW space. So now what people do is that they look at this equation in the momentum space rather than in position space. So I'll define now phi k and t is the standard Fourier transform. So it's an integral d3x. Phi x of t e to I k times x. So I'm doing the Fourier transform in the space. So time is as it were. And I can do this because I can do just the standard Fourier transform because dx1 and dx2 and dx3 are killing vectors. So actually you can still use the standard Fourier transform as you know it. Okay, so now if you do this, then this equation just becomes, well, phi double dot, 3h, phi dot, there nothing changed, but this thing is just k squared over a squared. So plus omega squared phi equals to 0. where my omega is just k over a. So now you see that we almost have a harmonic oscillator. So of course this would be the oscillation part. And whatever is proportional to the velocity is the friction part. So now you immediately know what the behavior is. Of course, if the middle term is much, much bigger than the last term, then you have overdamped thing, and so you have just frozen value of phi. So if the friction is too big, then it's just the field freezes. On the other hand, if this term is much smaller than that term, then you just have oscillations. So this trivial observation is actually key to understand why inflation is good. So let's put it in fancy terms. So first, introduce a new quantity HA, which is called commoving horizon. So now, if you remember, when we first started discussing inflation, we introduced this commoving Hubble radius. So compare to R hat, which was 1 over HA. So that was the commoving Hubble radius. And so we know that during the inflation, this commoving Hubble radius shrinks like crazy. And that's why actually the inflation explains those three puzzles. So now this thing is 1 over that. So this is like a k-space analog of this commoving radius. Okay, so this is just the k-space analog of this guy, HA. Okay, so now why I'm doing that, of course, I see in the middle term is H, and in the other term I have k over A. So precisely, I can say when there is, you know, too much friction and there is too much oscillation. So the first case is when k is much bigger than HA. And if this happens, then the oscillations. So now terminology, this is called mode is inside horizon. That's just the terminology. It's inside the horizon. But what we know is that because the last term dominates, we have the oscillations. So mode oscillates. Okay. So now the other possibility is that it's the other way around. So k is much smaller than HA. So now people say that it's outside horizon. And so in this case, the friction term is much bigger, and so the mode is frozen. Frozen mode. All right. So far, so clear. Everything is nice. So outside of the horizon, we have the overdamped oscillator. And inside, we have just normal oscillator without friction. OK, so now why is this interesting and important? Is that, of course, we want to consider two cases, the case of normal matter-dominated universe and the case of inflationary universe. So first, consider non-inflationary phase. So our universe is modeled by normal matter. So in particular, let me choose radiation. So for example, radiation. about full matter you could do as well, but variation is fine. So now you remember by heart now that for radiation phase, the scale factor goes like square root of t. Okay, so A is proportional to t 1/2. So this is what you derived already many times. And so H, which is A dot over A, just goes like 1 over t. And then HA, which is the comoving horizon I want to calculate, just goes like t to minus 1/2. Okay. So in other words, this comoving horizon is actually decreasing as the time proceeds. Okay. So this is true more generally. So more generally, this will be true we have that in non-inflationary phase, d over dt of this comoving horizon is smaller than 0. And so this will be true for matter and for other things as well. Okay. Of course, this makes sense because we know that the space analog of this, so the r hat, is shrinking like crazy. Sorry, that's in the inflationary. So it's actually getting bigger in the non-inflationary phase. So this one, which is the other way around, has to be getting smaller. Okay. So now what you can do is that you can plot what's happening with this HA. And let me do it still in this radiation phase, where we know that HA behaves like 1 over square root of t. So it actually behaves like this. And so now, in order to know whether your scale field oscillates or actually is frozen, you just consider some concrete k. So this is my k fixed. And then you see that k is smaller than HA in this region. So this will be when it is outside of the horizon. This is outside. And here it will be inside. In principle, I should be plotting another graph for phi, but you know that if it's outside, it's frozen. So really, the scale field here has the frozen value. Okay. Yeah, it's frozen value. Whereas inside, it actually starts oscillating. So I'll plot it in the same diagram, but this is, of course, the behavior of the scale field. Right? So now I'm plotting actually phi as a function of t. So in the first part, it is frozen. It has constant value. In the other part, actually, it is oscillating. OK? So this is what's happening here. So now, why is this interesting? Is of course, you know, once the radiation era started, then we have these oscillations of the plasma. So now I'm making a mind shift. So I'm making a shift from a field to actually plasma oscillations. But what you can sort of expect, so expect that the same graph here. I have k again here. This is my HA case. And then I have some, so this is t. And then at some t, actually, this is t of CMB. So this is when the CMB was released. And so you know that your plasma actually is frozen here. And then it starts oscillating after the mode refreezes. And then for a different k, you will have different oscillations. And then for other k, you will have even bigger oscillations. And so precisely, you know, this describes the oscillations for given k in the plasma. Okay, and so wherever you see a maximum, this will approximately correspond to the maximum of your CL as you see it for CMB, which is released after that. Okay, so this corresponds to high L mode in CMB. This is the low one, low L mode in CMB. And then depending on whether you have minimum or maximum, you see approximately the minimum or maximum in your CMB for that given L. So these are actually now not oscillations of the field, but they are plasma oscillations. Of course, I haven't proved that this is the same thing, but let's believe it is. Okay, on the other hand, in the inflationary phase, so for example, you can consider slow roll inflation when we know that our universe is basically expanding like this in the space. And again, you know by heart that the scale factor behaves exponentially for almost constant h. And so a times h, our co-moving horizon, a times h, again, is exponentially increasing. Okay. And if that is true, then we have a different picture than this one. So in this case, actually, k and t are here. So now our co-moving horizon is exponentially increasing. So we have something like this. This is our ha proportional to exponential of ht. And for a given k, my field, scalar field, will be oscillating here and will be frozen here. So frozen and then oscillating. Does it make sense? Okay, so now the art of understanding universe is putting these two pictures together, and then you understand everything about the universe. So here is the big picture fairy tale, so big picture fairy tale. And so the idea is that, you know, in the very early universe, after the inflation started, so presumably the only content of the universe was the inflaton field, was the scalar field. And this scalar field, of course, had some quantum fluctuations. So now, as the universe exponentially expands, these quantum fluctuations become classical. But they still, you know, fluctuate, the scalar field still fluctuates until the universe is actually expanded, until HA is bigger than this, and then the scalar field sort of freezes. Okay? And then you reemerge after here, after the radiation era started, you are still frozen with the scalar field, but then it starts oscillating again. Okay? And so these oscillations are somehow transferred to the oscillation of the plasma. And so now you see these oscillations of the plasma in your CMB. And of course, these oscillations, these density fluctuations, are origin of the galaxies and stuff like that. So that's the fairy tale. So idea is that the quantum fluctuations during inflation translation. Produce the right kind of inhomogeneities that eventually give rise to large scale structure in the universe. And so it's really these quantum mechanical fluctuations because that there'll be galaxy here and there won't be anything here and stuff like that. And also you can see them, you know, through this CMB fluctuations. So these things, these quantum fluctuations, and after they are actually stretched to be classical, before the inflation actually finished, these are called primordial fluctuations. So okay, so here's the picture. I'm just pasting the two pictures together. Okay, so here's my K. And then I keep going here. Okay. And so I have the inflation expansion for my Hubble co-moving radius is doing this. And then it's sort of, you know, something has to happen, nobody knows what. But then the radiation era starts again, and our co-moving radius is going down. So this is the line of HA. So if I consider one given K, then you know that you are oscillating here. Okay, so somewhere here, you produce these quantum mechanical fluctuations. So these are adiabatic modes generated quantum mechanically. So here, really, you have fluctuations of your inflaton field. And then, as the inflation proceeds, you know, it's believed that these quantum fluctuations become classical. Okay, so you have, for given k, I have the oscillations of the scalar field here. So somewhere here, the fluctuations already classical, already classical fluctuations. So why is so? Okay, so very naively, I have like teeny tiny fluctuations, quantum mechanical fluctuations. Now I expand my universe like crazy. Because I expand my universe like crazy, I stretch these fluctuations to something much bigger. Okay, and so it's reasonable that after the stretching, actually, the fluctuations are already classical. So now this is a big fairy tale. What you can actually do is you can calculate what is the commutations of the scalar field momentum and position, so phi and phi dot commutator, and you actually find that at the end of the inflation, the commutator is equal to zero. So that's why actually this thing is classical. So now this point here, because the horizon HA is now bigger than K, so this is for my fixed K, right? So this is for fixed K. So now the horizon is bigger, so people call it horizon exit. So this thing here is the horizon exit. And then the field is outside of the horizon, so it's frozen. So it's conserved value of the field. So So if you want to divide it into these epochs, so this is the inflation epoch. And then something has to happen with the inflaton, and so it has to, you have to produce these standard particles, and you have to heat them up. So that's the reheating. So somewhere here is the reheating epoch. And after the reheating, you produce all your standard matter particles, and they are quite hot, and so you'll start your radiation era. But you know that once you have the standard matter particles, you have really the plasma and plasma oscillations. So here, you already have the plasma. But because you are now, again, K is bigger than HA, and then you have oscillations again. And as I said, this is your T of CMB. And so different oscillations, different Ks actually start at, you know, different times. Anyway, and so here the CMB is released. So now you have the CMB. CMB is released. And so today you just observe it over here. And so what you have to do is that you have to transfer how these fluctuations in the temperature actually transfer into CLs. How the fluctuations of the plasma transfer into CL, which you observe now. Okay. So now what is actually quite well understood in this picture is whatever happens with, okay, so you start with some fluctuations here, okay, and then you transfer them to the time when CMB was released. So this is low energy physics. It's basically, you know, how the plasma behaves. It's a dirty physics. You have lots of particles. You have protons, electrons. You have photons. You have all these things. You have dark matter and stuff like that. But this is, you know, well understood physics. So low energy dirty physics, and so this is people use the Boltzmann equation, and they put all this particle content of the things, and so this is actually done by Boltzmann codes. Okay, so this part is well understood. So now, at the beginning, you just have quantum mechanical thing. So you have just the scalar field in some fixed metric, or maybe not fixed metric. You couple them. So here I had a fixed metric, but of course you should, in principle, consider both of them dynamical. So here you have to quantize geometry plus the scalar field to understand these quantum fluctuations. And due to Malnasina and others, Mukhanov and other people, this is also well understood. Okay, so this is also okay. How to generate these quantum fluctuations. And for the rest of the course, I will try to give you some hints how this is done. I will not really calculate it, but you will if you wanted to in your homework. Okay, so now then, you know, how this becomes classical is, I think, yeah, maybe okay, maybe not. So now what's happening here, nobody knows, because you don't know what the equation of state of the matter is. However, there is some very powerful theorem, which is Weinberg's theorem. Weinberg's theorem, which says, you know, no matter what the equation of state of that matter during the reheating was, you always have one conserved mode, which is the adiabatic mode, which is actually the value is conserved and it emerges over here. It's a beautiful theorem. I don't understand the proof. And I don't understand whether it's a trivial statement or non-trivial statement. But probably it's a non-trivial statement because Weinberg is behind it. But anyway, so he's basically saying, you know, they'll always be conserved, no matter what equation of state is. So what we proved here, that it's frozen, provided that we have scalar field in a fixed background. But here, you already have, you know, lots of, so here you start having plasma, you have to reheat your thing. So there's some crazy things happening. But despite that, it's actually still conserved value here. And so it reemerges here. okay? And that's basically it. So that's the big picture of what how people understand that actually the structure in the universe as we see it today emerged. Okay, that's the leading theory. Of course, if you don't believe in inflation, then this is. But then what is really actually important is that these oscillations, as they emerge from reheating, are very, very nice oscillations. Okay, so in order to get these nice oscillations, you have to have some theory why they are so nice and why all the fields basically behave the same way or more and stuff like that. And so it's precisely the inflation theory gives you that. However, it's not entirely true because, of course, this initial data are somehow connected with these initial data. Right, and so actually, in order to set up the inflation properly, you have to discuss what the initial data were here. You just basically postpone the problem: why nice initial data are here, why nice initial data are here. Okay. Oh no, I talk too much. Are there any questions? Good questions. Yes.
Can you see the fluctuations like in anything other than the CMB?
These fluctuations. Yeah, precisely. So here, these are fluctuations of the density of the plasma, and so eventually, you know, they give rise to galaxies and stuff like that. So yeah. So you see them in large scale structure, not only in CMB but also in large scale structure. All right. So okay. So now for the rest of the course, I'll just do the simple calculation. Which is, you know, to understand how these fluctuations are produced here, because this part of the calculation, although very, very well understood, is actually dirty physics, and you have to do it numerically. All right. So for this, we want to understand quantum field theory in KF space. So we want to really couple the scalar field, our inflaton, with the metric, and we want to study its quantum fluctuations. So now, of course, the gravitational field has 2 degrees of freedom in it, and the scalar field has another one. So you have 3 degrees of freedom in the early universe, in the simplest model. But the problem is to extract these degrees of freedom. And so because the metric has 10, you have to gauge fix things. And that's where things actually get messy. And we will not do the calculation, but it will be described in your homework. So let me start baby steps. So basics of QFT in KF space. And actually, you understand QFT in KF space once you understand harmonic oscillator with time-dependent frequency. OK, so the first part will be time dependent harmonic oscillator. So baby step. So you first consider really the Lagrangian, which is just 1/2 Q dot square minus 1/2, and then omega. But now I'll let omega depend on time t q square. Okay, so that's the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. And let me discuss this theory a little bit. So first step, of course, is to write down the equations of motion. So equation of motion is just q double dot plus omega square q equals to 0. So now what you want to always do is to find a nice scalar product among your solutions. So assume that we have two solutions. So for two solutions of this equation of motion, so for two solutions f1 and f2, you define a scalar product between them. And scalar product in this sense is doesn't mean that it's actually symmetric, but it actually means that it's something which is conserved or something like that. And so I define it in this way, f1 and f2 is just F1 star and D F2 over DT. It's actually total derivative because it only depends on T. And then minus D F1 star over DT and F2. And then you evaluate that at some time equal to zero. So this is my scalar product. It has some nice properties and some bad properties. So first of all, it's antisymmetric. So it's actually not really the scalar product in that sense. But otherwise, it has nice properties. What it is actually Wronskian. Okay. So this is my scalar product. And so now you want to classify the solutions of your equation of motion with respect to the scalar product. So you want to normalize your solution. So given a solution f to our equations of motion, you want to normalize it. So you say that f and f is equal to 1. So that's my one solution of this equation of motion. But you know that because this is a second order differential equation, you need two solutions to have the complete basis. So then actually the trick is that you can take the complex conjugate. So f star will also be a solution, also a solution, which is independent in the sense of the scalar product. So it will be the normalization is now minus 1. It's easy to check. And if you take the scalar product between f and f star, it's 0. So they are independent. Okay. So the statement is, if I have one solution, I can take its complex conjugate, and I have another solution of my equation of motion. And that means that the general solution, so a general solution Q of t is just given by a linear combination of f and f star. Okay, so typically you would put a times f and b times f star, but I'll call it differently. I'll call it a f times f of t, and then a f dagger f star of t. Okay, so these are just here, they are just numbers. But that's the general solution for my equation of motion. Okay, so now we can also calculate what is the corresponding momentum. Well, why do you want momentum? Once you have momentum and position, you can quantize, right? So the momentum is just dl over dq dot. Remember your classical mechanics course. And so the only thing, okay, so if you look at this Lagrangian here, it's just q dot. And so if I want to dot these things, AF and AF dagger are just constant, so I'll just get a f dot here and f star dot. So it's AF f dot plus AF dagger f dot star. So that's your momentum. So far everything is classical. And AF and AF dagger are just numbers. But you now just quantize by imposing Dirac commutation relations. So you promote your Q and P to operators. I will not put hat on them. So quantize, impose commutation relations. So now my Q and P are operators, and you require that Q of T and P of T is equal to I H bar is 1. Okay, so now everything is quantum mechanical. And these are operators. Of course, if you look at your Q, and if you want to promote it to the operator, so F is still classical solution, and F star so as well, but now AF and AF digger instead of numbers will be operators. Okay, and so you can plug whatever the Q is here and whatever the P is there, and you will get commutation relations for AF and AF digger. And of course, there is no surprise. So this translates to a commutation relation AF and AF digger equals to I. But I am also imposing that QQ is 0 and PP is 0. So the other ones will be also 0. So AF, AF will be 0, and AF digger, AF digger will be 0. OK. And so we are done with quantization, basically. So the only thing is that you want to identify vacuum. And so just to remember that our basic solution was given by this function f, which was the solution of my equations of motion. I'll call it f vacuum. And it's simply so denoted by 0 and f. And it's something you say, this is an annihilation operator. This is the creation operator. And so the f vacuum will be annihilated by AF. So this is defined by saying this is true. Then I'll define an excited state. So I have n particles now, or nf. And this is defined by acting with the creation operator n times on it. And there is some stupid prefactor, which I don't understand why it is there, but doesn't matter. Probably it's boson, so I don't know. N factorial, 1 over square root of n factorial. And then AF dagger n times on your vacuum. So this is the n excited state for our basis f. And then we have a number operator, f number operator, and f, which is just you annihilate and then you create, you put it back. So af dagger af. And of course, when this operator acts on my n excited state, just gives me n, okay? So nf on nf is just n nf. All right, and so we're done with quantization. So this is all very nice, but we have just chosen some random solution f to start with. And then we proceeded with the quantization, and we defined, you know, what is the corresponding vacuum, what is the corresponding excited state. We can, however, as well, choose a different solution, G, instead of F. Of f to start with. So now instead of starting with you know, this solution f, we start with another solution of my classical equations of motion, which will be g. Okay, and so then you just write q of t as a g, and then g of t, and then a g digger g star of t. Again, I assume that G is normalized, so GG is 1. And then you quantize, and you find that this thing, Q and P, has to be equal to I. So AG and AG dagger is equal to I, AG, and then AG dagger equals to I. And of course, you can define G vacuum. And you can define G excited state, an excited state. So now N of G. And you can you can define NG, the operator NG. You know, how many particles are there? Okay. So of course, you know, choosing G corresponds to choosing a different observer, right? So in principle, of course, this may not be true. And you are not, you know, people are not accustomed to that. If you choose completely different observer, actually maybe they see different vacua, or maybe they see different number of particles and stuff like that. So that's something which, you know, people doing QFT in Minkowski space are not typically familiar with, because you always choose preferred observers. You talk about Minkowski space, but you also talk about inertial observers. And so for inertial observers, actually, they agree on what the vacuum is, and they agree on how many particles they see. But as we will see in a minute, if you are in curved space, or if you have actually observers which are not connected by Lorentz transformations or linear transformations, then actually the number of particles can vary as you see it. OK, so now let me do this one-line calculation, which is very simple. Before I do that, let me introduce one more thing which I'll need. So because F is a solution of my equation of motion, and so is G, I should be able to expand one in terms of the other. Okay, so we can write G. This is my new solution, and because it's a solution, you must be able to write it in terms of the basis f. Okay, so there will be some linear combination of f and f star. Okay, this is all very simple, but these coefficients alpha and beta have their own name. Very important coefficients. They are called Bogoliubov coefficients. So. Bogoliubov coefficients. But you know, this equation is just saying you, yeah, I have complete basis in F and F star. This is a solution, one complete solution. So I have to be able to express it in terms of these things. Okay. So now, of course, I can extract what this beta and alpha are by doing a scale product. So for example, alpha, I'll write what it is, f and g. It's a scalar product with f and g. Well, if you look at this, I make a scalar product, so I have g here. I make a scalar product with f. So I'll have scalar product of ff, which is 1. So that gives me alpha. And I'll have a scalar product with f and f star, but at 0, because they are orthogonal. OK, so this is what alpha is. And similarly, you would find that beta is now minus, coming from that f star. F star is minus 1. F star and G. So this is how you calculate alpha and beta. You would also find a useful relation that alpha square minus beta square equals to 1. Okay. So now you can write GT in two ways. So GT, in one way, is AG times, it's AFF. I'm doing stupid. Q of T, right? Q of T. I have AG times G plus AG dagger times G star, or AF times F plus AF dagger times F star. But now I can write one in terms of the other. So I can write G in terms of alpha times F plus beta times F star. And then you can write G star as well. You just make a star on that. And then you compare whatever you see on the left-hand side is whatever you see on the right-hand side. And you get the relation between AF and AG. Okay? So do it yourself. I'll write an inverse relation, which I will need. Okay, so the inverse relation. So we get a relation between AF, AG, and so on. And I'll invert this 2x2 matrix, and I'll just write the inverse relation. So inverse of this, and you can check it yourself, is that AG is alpha times AF minus beta star times AF dagger. And AG dagger is, of course, dagger of this. So it's alpha star AF dagger and minus beta AF. Okay? So this is what you should get if you do the inversion of 2x2 matrix by comparing whatever is over there. Okay? And so now I said maybe the observers actually see different number of particles. So how can you see that? So let me calculate how many G particles are in F vacuum. So the observer F sees a vacuum, but actually this vacuum may have G number of particles. So let's see how to calculate this. So we are interested, so we are in vacuum, 0F, and then we simply apply the number operator of G particles to this vacuum. Okay, so this is 0F, and then we have AG dagger, AG, 0F. And now you plug whatever you see here. So you plug alpha star, so this is 0F, and then alpha star AF dagger minus beta AF, and then AG is alpha AF minus beta star AF dagger, 0F. Okay. So now, whenever AF hits my 0F, I get 0 because the vacuum is annihilated by AF. So for example, this time here, and it acts over here, you get 0. So similarly, if you have AF dagger acting on this guy, then you get a 0. So these two terms actually produce 0, and the only thing is with the betas, which is left. Okay, so this is just minus beta times minus beta star, which is b square, magnitude b square. And then you have AF dagger acting on 0F, which is the number particle, but it's only four. Okay. So this is just b square. Okay, so as long as this coefficient beta, the Bogoliubov coefficient beta, which connects the bases G and F, is non-trivial, you will see different number of particles in the vacuum than the other observer. Okay, and so of course this is the origin of many nice phenomena. So of the Andrew effect, of the Hawking radiation, of the particle production in the early universe, and so on. So we'll discuss particle production in the early universe. You may a little bit discuss about Andrew. Hawking is too far, black hole physics, so we will not discuss Hawking thing here. But this is, you know, this is the origin of all these very nice phenomena, which, seem very strange at the first sight. Are there any questions? Okay, thanks.